about that.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Love, Light, and Passion, where award-winning social media professional Wendy Manganiello and her guests talk about turning your ideas and dreams into reality. Wendy believes that every woman can have it all, and she takes away all of the stress that comes with the social media aspect of business by providing a number of resources, including Facebook ad creation and implementation, management, coaching and training, strategy, and so much more. This show is dedicated to the loving memory of Sean Stevenson, whose instinctive ability to motivate others taught Wendy how to take a dream and allow the universe to make it into an abundant reality. Contact Wendy to do the 7 Days to Social Media Sanity Facebook Challenge and have her help you to make your goals and actions match your business plan. Don't end this year not socially ready for next year. And now, your host, Wendy Manganiello.
Hello, everyone. We are back for another week of Love, Light, and Happiness. I'm, as always, so excited to be on air and to speak with people that are passionate and love what they do. This week, we have a special guest, and I'm actually excited about this because I think we've tried to do this before, and for whatever reason, it didn't work out then. So we have her now, and it's great. She is also, I know I talk about that private group we have all the time with Sean Stevenson's group that we all are still connected in, but she is also part of that group, and her name is Edie Weinstein. Did I say that
Weinstein. It rhymes.
Edie Weinstein, and we've actually just became friends through Facebook, and I've been following everything she does for quite a while now, and she's always a ray of light and positivity. So just a little background on Edie. She's an LSW, she's a colorfully creative journalist, inspiring transformational speaker. She is an interfaith minister, bliss coach, and the author of The Bliss Mistress Guide to Transforming the Ordinary into Extraordinary. She calls herself an optimistic who sees the world through the eyes of possibility, which is really what this show, we're going to talk about this today, and because she has just recently had some big life changes happen, we'll talk about that and how she stays in that state of optimism. And so I'm really, really excited. Hi, Edie, welcome.
Hi, thank you. And I've forgotten our initial connection was through Sean. Bless her. I mean, she's been, when did she pass? How long ago was that?
Okay, let me think about this because I had it come up on my timeline.
More than a year.
It's been more than a year. It's been more than a year. And so I don't know about you, but a lot of the guests I bring on have known about her, and yet I still have not ran out of guests to know her. But I feel blessed that she left such a connection of men and women. I'm going to have Stephen on the show not too late. She worked with him right before, a year before she passed away. And so I just kind of feel like the show and the people I've been able to connect with, it still has her presence and everything that we do.
Oh,
so it's really exciting to have
absolutely.
You here.
Absolutely. Well, she, my connection with Sean, just so you know, came through a woman named Tiffany Reed, who I met at a book signing event. She and I were doing a book release event at the same time at Big Blue Marble Bookstore in Philadelphia. And she said, you've got to meet this amazing woman named Sean Stevenson, who is part of something called the Circle of Ten. And it's not just 10 people, obviously. It's, you know, like being a 10 in life, living your life as a 10. And when I met her, you know, there are some people that walk into your life and you're just dazzled by them. And I was just blown away by Sean. And we didn't really spend that much time together. I think we may have only seen each other 3 or 4 times in, you know, before she passed. And one of the times left a really lasting imprint with me. She asked me to speak at the library in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, near where I live. And afterwards, she put together this calendar of her speakers. And I became a calendar girl, which I thought was really cool. So I still have that. And her picture's on it, some of the other women who spoke. And it's on my kitchen counter. Even though it was like 3 or 4 years ago, it still feels so present. And Sean Shawn is a guardian angel for a lot of us. So I'm glad she brought us together as well. So I did, just had to mention that. So thank you.
That is so incredible. And I met her after the Circle of Ten. I didn't even know her then. I had met her through eWomen. But again, that connectivity of who she was, like I've met all of these lovely ladies who knew her from Circle of Ten, who started there, and then people who met her afterwards. And the stories that are shared are incredible, because some ladies that we have in our group have never met her. They never met her in person. And other people, so I just think that that's amazing that people, and not just Shawn, but people in general are put on this earth and they can just connect light together through other people. And she was certainly one of those people who did it. And I think there's others out there and that we can still continue to do that when we talk to each other and with things like this. So, I started the show just because I told her for like a year before I was going to do it and never did. And I was like, well, this is a good time to do it and connect
Absolutely.
People about what they're passionate about. So that's what I want to talk to you about, because I like this idea of the opti, and it's not optimistic, it's optimistic. Mm-hmm. There's
right.
a hype in the middle of
yeah.
that word. And
right.
So tell me what that is. What does that mean?
Sure. Well, first of all, like a lot of people who are listening into the show, I tap into my intuition. I get messages in dreams and meditations, and words come through, and I say, okay, what does that mean? And God says, you'll know. You'll figure it out. So one night I woke up in the middle of the night, as I often do, with these words pouring through. I'm not just optimistic, O-P-T-I-M-I-S-T-I-C, but I am an optimistic who sees the world through the eyes of possibility. And that stuck with me. And I thought, what would that be like to live an optimistical life, to see possibilities in the poop, to see mm-hmm. things that don't always feel so good, and be able to turn it around. And I think about all the people in my life that I see as resilient thrivers, folks that have been through all kinds of major life changes and challenges. And I said, what is it that helps them stay resilient? And I said, I think it's that quality of optimisticism. And it doesn't have to be mystical, like woo-woo kind of stuff, because I think this is really grounded in reality. I know that when I feel, I don't even know how to describe it, when I feel like an optimistic, I feel much more centered, grounded, accomplished. So what I did with that is I mentioned it to a friend, and she created a meme, and she found this photograph of an elephant sitting on a bird's nest with a propeller on the back of it, wearing a top hat, and a little bird sitting on its back. And she put the words, I'm not just an optimist, I'm an optimistic who sees the world through the eyes of possibility. And this meme made it around the world. A year ago, on my birthday, I got an email from somebody that said, Julian Lennon posted this on his Facebook page. And I went, nah, you're kidding, right? And they said, no, go check. So I looked at it, I said, wow, this is exciting. So since then, those two little guys, the elephant and the bird, have made the rounds on their, what I call their worldwide whirlwind tour. And I'm actually writing a book now called The Way of the Optimistic. And it will talk about that, about ways that people can live more optimistical lives.
That's incredible. And I think I've seen that meme. I'm going
mm-hmm.
back and
yeah.
And I
yep.
am sure that I have seen that meme. That is.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll send it over to you.
Yeah, please do. I will definitely repost it and start all over again, because I really have seen that before. And I thought, oh, how cute that was. So
thank you.
So when because you mentioned something, and I just want to stop there, because a lot of times people in general, if you start talking about things like, envisioning something, inspiration, staying optimistic, they do get this like, oh, you are grounded in reality. And so, which brings me to another question of, if that's the case, those people who are more, they feel like, belief in those things are not realistic. They have a harder time with that. How Can they get there, or do you have to be born to that?
No, I think resilience is learned. I think turning our lives around is something that anybody can do. I do know that it helps to have supporters. I say that I have a lot of yay-sayers in my life, and I can't think of any naysayers. You know, there are people in my life who have been wonderful cheerleaders for pretty much anything that I've wanted to do. I grew up with amazing parents who told me, you know, you could do or be anything you want. As long as you can support yourself and you're happy with it, we're happy for you. Go for it. So I think that helps. You know, having that kind of support does make a difference. But we can find that. Think about what it is. I mean, what I found is that everything that exists in life right now was once an idea in someone's head. You know, this phone that we're talking on, the computers that we're sitting in front of, the desk that, you know, my little laptop is sitting on, was once an idea in someone's mind before it became a physical, tangible reality. Same thing with jobs, same thing with relationships. I remember hearing a story about this spiritual teacher who wanted to create an ashram or a center or a program of some kind. And somebody says, well, where are you going to find the money for that? And this person said, where's the money going to come from? And he said, from wherever it is at the moment. So anything you want, whether, again, it's a relationship, a job, health, a home, a car, whatever opportunities you want, they're out there somewhere. And they're going to arrive from wherever they are at the moment. So if you can look at that, that helps it feel more real.
And it's so funny you say that. So I have to let you in. And I don't know when this started, but a couple of weeks ago, I guess it was, my husband's been working out of town. I've been doing this single mom thing. And God bless every single mom out there, because it is not easy. But
I can tell you. Yep. Me too.
Yeah, not an easy thing to do, but, you know, with everything, and then we had other stuff going on, you know, because life just happens, and talking about grounding and, you know, knowing that it's going to come or anything, somehow I was sitting in meditation or quiet, and I got the mantra in my head, the mountain is already moved. So anything that's been like coming up as an obstacle for me, I just remind myself, like, the mountain's already moved. It may look like it's right there, but it's already moved, and I'm going to be walking through this. And it has really helped change my perspective on things. And I think that goes along with what you're saying, because, you know, a lot of us can stay in, oh, this isn't going to work, or that naysayer, or, you know, but if you can look at it as the mountain's already moved, then you just have to wait and to see when you see it, you know, not
right.
That it's not
right
there.
Yeah, and it's what Wayne Dyer used to say, that, you know, you'll see it when you believe it, not the other way around, which is what we were taught, you know, that we were taught that I'll believe it when I see it. You got to see it to believe it. You got to be able to, I mean, the other way around, you got to believe it to see it. You know, something could be right in front of you. You know, anything that you want could be right in front of you. Your deepest heart's desire could be right there in front of you. And if you got the blinders on, you're not going to see it. So take the blinders off.
So, I know for me that getting there is a process. Getting there to that point has been, and it's like an onion. It really is. I'm in it. Good, I get it. And then other days, not so good. So how did you start on this process to start? I mean, I know you told me about the inspiring new dream, but because now you're very passionate with helping others, you do writing for on drug and alcohol issues and stuff. So how did you get through that process? I mean, because did you wake up as a young lady one day, or what was that starting catalyst to start to really say, I want to do this differently than the naysayers, or what was that?
Well, I think I've always been trying to keep up. I had asthma when I was a child. I had foot problems when I was a child. You know, I used to do everything I could to keep up with the other kids, so that I didn't feel left behind. So I was always a go-getter. My parents also taught me to be a go-giver. They were very generous and kind. They were, in addition to doing full-time work and raising my sister and me, they were volunteers in the community, so they taught me about that. So I had that behind me. I had a lot of love and a lot of family support. Throughout my life, I have had amazing friends that are my family of choice. I am incredibly blessed with so many wonderful, loving people in my life. That helps. So I've wanted to give back. I've wanted to do what I could to be, you know, to be out there in the world and to be a go-giver. And when I thought about what I wanted to do professionally, when I was a little kid, I never said, oh, I want to be this when I grow up. I had no clue. My degrees are in psychology and social work. I don't have a journalism training background. And it wasn't until 1988 when my husband and I started a magazine called Visions, had to do with holistic health and wellness, based in the Philadelphia area, that my journalism career actually started. And we did it for 10 years. And then he died in December of 1998. And 6 months before that, we sold the magazine, and I became a freelance journalist. I was also a social worker. I was working in a nursing home at the time. So I was building the career that I have now, not having a clue that I was doing that. So I went through a lot of my professional career doing social work. When Michael died, I became an interfaith minister, went to the New Seminary in New York, and got ordained. And I've been doing that ever since as well. I do weddings, baby blessings, funerals, stuff like that. Still, part of the path was writing, because I wrote the ceremonies. So writing was always a passion for me. Writing was always something that called to me. And that creative spark doesn't leave me. I never get writer's block. I get writer's runs, is what I call it, and I can't shut it off. So for those writers out there, listen to the muse. Let the muse guide you. You know, everything is a writing prompt. Everything is a creative prompt. So listening to that voice, whether you call it creativity, a spark, an inner voice, whatever you see around you, let that influence your creativity, your whatever work you're doing. So I think that had a lot to do with it too. And then the drug and alcohol, the way that got started was that in the early 1980s, between college and graduate school, I was working for the South Jersey Council on Alcoholism, doing education in schools about drug and alcohol abuse prevention. And at the time, I was really green. I had no clue what I was doing. I used to use cue cards and notes, and I'd be stumbling over my words, and I felt really awkward and quite inept. So I asked the man that I was working with at the time, you know, how do you do this? And because he'd been doing it like 10 years at that point. And he said, stories. When you have stories, you'll be able to do this. So I wish I could track him down. I don't even remember his name. To track him down and say, okay, after all these years, I finally have stories. Mm-hmm. And so that's how that got started. And then I did drug and alcohol counseling, both inpatient and outpatient as well.
And you know, so I don't say this often, but so I haven't had a drink or drug in 24 years now. So that's why.
Oh, bless you.
So, wow. But what amazes me is that in order to work in any, because my background is nonprofits and people with disability and welfare to work. And, you know, before I did what I do now, and plus we run the homeless ministry, but there is a key thing. And I think that going back to the optimistic thing is that in order to do that type of work, this is what I have found for myself, and you let me know if this is true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. For what we do, you have to be grounded in that optimism, in that positive, because sometimes what you see is so heart-wrenching around you, especially when there's somebody who's not getting it. Mm-hmm. So how do you, because for any of those people who are in that calling field to go, because they're serial helpers, I happen to be one of them, that was my, you know, but how do you, as somebody who's maybe living with drugs and alcohol, or how does that person, because you have background in this, stay? Because I know for me that can be the highest burnout rate. It's not necessarily what I'm doing, it's what I'm not doing to stay positive and yet not let that person affect me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if we can ever not let anybody affect us. And first of all, I want to congratulate you on your ongoing recovery. Bless you. That's huge. And my, I can say this too, and I have no problem saying it. I don't have a substance addiction, but I am a workaholic, and I'll tell you how that affected my life. And also, you know, recovering codependent, you know, the caregiver thing. So one way is to realize that we are not responsible for anybody else's behavior. We didn't, you know, if you have someone in your life with an addiction, what's the thing? You didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it. But you can be there to love and support them, but ultimately it's an inside job. And I know so many people, myself included, that have attempted to fix, save, heal, cure. You know, I call it save your behavior. And that's actually part of, in my mind, the definition of codependence, is when you know, you have the Wonder Woman cape on, or the, you know, the S on your chest of Superman, trying to, you know, to fix somebody who you perceive is broken. I don't believe anybody is irretrievably broken. We have broken open places in our lives where love can, you know, the love and the light and all that can shine in and shine out if we let it. But we are not broken people. We have wounds. We have you know, traumas that we've experienced. But to be able to see somebody through their strengths, not through just the trauma that they've experienced, can help them get better. And also to take, you know, if you're in a codependent role, to ask yourself, what's the secondary gain? What am I getting out of being the caregiver? And for me, it was what I would say was insurance that I would be loved, because who wouldn't love a caregiver? And now I realize that in doing that, I wasn't being genuine. I wasn't from a clean, clear place being supportive. I wanted to be indispensable. And I still sometimes do, but nowhere near as much. So think about that. So good self-care is really important if you're in the role of someone who loves somebody with an addiction. And we all have addictions in one form or another, that I know for sure.
And so let's go. When somebody can live in what I call it, is, you know, for your optimism, but I call it live in the light. That's, what exists for them? What makes that person different than somebody who doesn't live there? You know, like what is that line? And it, you know, knowing that we go in and out, but what's that line like? What's the difference?
Well, I think the difference is learned resilience. I bless my parents for teaching me how to be resilient, how to bounce back. And there are some people that never learned that skill. And it, as I mentioned earlier, it is learnable. It is certainly possible to learn how to bounce back from nearly anything. And one thing that I would tell clients regularly is you have survived everything that has ever happened in your life because you're here to tell about it. So what makes you think you're not going to get through this one? You know, and look back at the skills that you've acquired since then. Look back at your support team. And if you don't have one, find one. You know, if you are dealing with addiction issues, you know, 12-step is not the only way. I mean, some people swear by it. Some people swear at it. But going to some kind of support meeting. So whether it's AA, NA, whether it's Codependence Anonymous, which I actually was in for 6 years. I did a 5.5-day inpatient program for folks, not did as in led, but did as in participated in. I was a client. At a 5.5-day program for folks that were dealing with codependency issues. And the majority of the people there had family members with active substance addictions. I think I might have been the only one that didn't. And one woman who had major, you know, on the surface, major, major issues, looked at me on the second day there and said, you know, you're the sickest one here. I said, what do you mean? And she said, you know, you think you're only here because your husband and your therapist thought you needed to be here. But you know, take your therapist hat off. You're here to get help, and you deserve help as much as anybody does here, and you need it maybe more than anybody here. Like, whoa. So after being a little taken aback, I said, you know what? She's right. Fortunately, there were another 3.5 days left. And I really dove into what was going on. And then after that, spent 6 years going to CODA meetings. So know when you need help. And so many of us that are professional caregivers are also personal caregivers. And you mentioned the single parent thing. My husband was ill for 6 years with hepatitis C before he died. And that was part of the time that I went to CODA meetings, was because he didn't insist, but he encouraged. And, you know, here I was being his physical caregiver, but also emotional caregiver. And it just wasn't working. It didn't feel good. It felt draining. So going to the meetings was helpful. But there are also non-12-step programs like Smart Recovery. There's another one that I just found out about recently called Refuge Recovery, and it's got a Buddhist slant to it. So you can look that up as well. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but
I've heard a lot of them, but I haven't heard of that one. I'll have to see what that is.
Yeah, Refuge Recovery. I think it's Noah Levine. He's got a group called, that he organized called Dharma Punks, P-U-N-X. So he's a tattooed Buddhist who started Refuge Recovery.
I think that's awesome.
He's amazing.
So let's explore that a little bit more because there is, I think in the profession of helping others, whether it's addicts, it doesn't matter what you're helping. I think when you're in that helping profession, there is a higher burnout rate, and you do get to the point where, and I don't know if you have felt like this, but I've certainly felt like this. If you are the one in, if you're the one in the area, I know when I worked in Atlantic County, I had a higher level job in an organization. So the last thing I felt like I could do was let my guard down to say I had any problems as far as, like anything that was going on at home. I mean, it took working with Sean and people like Marilyn Kleinberg and all of that to say, okay, this is what's really going on in my life, because I, at that time, had built up a wall saying, this is what people in my arena, in my head, I had built this up, expect me to be like. So, and I don't know, and I'm sure I'm not the only person who goes through that. When you get to that, in your head, you think you get to the status and then you're supposed to have no more problems. or you don't feel safe in being able to reach out because there people are too close to talk to people, essentially.
Yeah.
Going on.
Yeah. And there is, you're right, there is an incredibly high rate of burnout for those of us in, in the helping professions, whether you're a doctor, a nurse, a social worker, a therapist, a coach, a teacher, a parent, whatever it is, that we think we have to be above and beyond, doing what needs to be done for other people. And by doing that, we limit ourselves. And there's I don't know if you've heard the term compassion fatigue, where you're just all grieved out and you're running a court low. And I've done that for years, where I just kept giving until there was nothing left to give. And you can't fill somebody else's cup if your cup is empty. That's not just words, that's reality.
Right.
Yeah.
And, it's funny because my husband and I run a homeless ministry, and we still run it. I mean, none of that has changed. But we found that we were certainly in that spot, and we were like, how did we get here? We kind of know better. And yet, we found ourselves in that and had to kind of reevaluate to make sure that we were taken care of as a family so that we could go out and continue to help others. And I think that sometimes it happens, you really don't realize it's happening until you're in it, and then you have resentment and you're like, wait a second, this isn't working.
Absolutely. And it is listening to your gut, listening to the messages and say, okay, I need a rest. I need to slow down and not be taking care of everybody else all the time. It's that oxygen mask metaphor. I talk about it a lot, but I don't always live it. I mean, and when I say you should know better, there are times when I use it to berate myself, like, oh, come on, you should know better. Whether I should or whether I shouldn't, I know better, but it's more about willingness. I don't think that people do the best they can. I think they do the best they're willing to do. And sometimes I'm not willing to do it. Like, I don't want to, But I've learned that if I want my life to be better, if I want positive changes to happen, I need to do what it takes to allow them to happen. And that's been a big word for me, allow, because I was so good at making things happen. And now I allow them to happen. When I was out there doing, pushing, efforting, I exhausted myself. You were talking about burnout. June 12th, 2014, I had a huge wake-up call. 55 years old, I had a heart attack. And I never in a million years would have expected that. My mom died of congestive heart failure, but she was 86 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that contributed to, you know, to her condition. But I'm sure that in addition to that experience, you know, I look at, you know, my diet wasn't the greatest. I was eating foods that were processed and high in sodium, high in cholesterol, so that's changed. My exercise routine, even though I was going to the gym much more back then, the workouts weren't as intense. In fact, the heart attack happened on the way home from the gym. I was driving home, and bam, yeah. I just had what I thought was a normal workout, and the heart attack happened. And what I do now as a result of that is that I teach other women how to recognize the symptoms of an impending heart attack. And our symptoms are different for men. Mine were jaw pain and tightness, like somebody grabbing my jaw, torrential sweat, like worse than any hot flash you'd ever imagine, lightheadedness and dizziness, palpitations, and searing heartburn. It's not the left side arm, chest pain that men have. It's very different. So I've learned how to recognize, I learned back then how to recognize them and how to tell other women. But for months, maybe even years before, I was having symptoms that I ignored because I attributed them to menopause. Sleeplessness, dizziness, lightheadedness, again, the sweats. And that might have been a warning that I didn't pay attention to. So I'm hearing some talk in the background. I don't know if you're hearing it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't hear that. I don't know.
Okay. Interesting. It sounds like we're having a conversation with somebody else there, too.
Okay. I don't hear it. It's not coming up on the real recording.
Oh, good. Okay. So maybe I'm hearing voices again. I don't know. Although, you know, the thing about that is being a psychiatric social worker, I do know the difference between psychotic voices.
Yes.
And spirit speaking. So I do. I have had messages from spirit to tell me stuff. You know.
So here was something else. So you've had an interesting couple of weeks because I asked. I went on to the group, I guess, a couple months ago and said I'm bringing the show back and starting the book and so you had said yes. You know, I want to be on it and I'm so glad you're here. And then in the last couple of, not even the last week, it was last week, right? Yeah. So
two weeks ago. Yeah.
2 weeks ago. Okay. So I was strolling down Facebook and I was like, well, this is a big change.
So let's talk about that
because I've seen the other side and I think through this whole entire time, I've seen one thing of like, okay, this kind of stinks, but then you were right back on the, okay, I'm going to move forward through this.
Right. Well, Wendy's talking about is for the last year and a half, I've had what I call my dream job. I work from home as a web content writer for a large corporation, large company. And I loved my job. It was just amazing. And I was writing articles about addiction recovery and mental health issues for various websites. And because of corporate downsizing, I lost my job. And it didn't, I don't know how to describe it. I was kind of, I wouldn't say blindsided by it because I knew anything was possible. I knew that, you know, it could happen like any of us. And none of us, even though we like to believe our jobs are secure, we never know. So the day that it happened, I did what I typically do is what I call a spiritual bypass. Where I said, okay, it's going to be okay. God's going to take care of it. It'll be fine. You know, I'm still going to do what I need to do to find other work, which I did. But I thought, all right, I'm going to deal with this. Now, that's not always the healthiest approach because in my case, that contributed to the heart attack too. I covered over a lot of loss in my life saying, okay, we're going to move through this. We're going to do this. You know, I was kind of the Girl Scout leader and say, all right, guys, we're going to, you know, kids, we're going to get through the woods and everything's going to be fine. Excuse me. So I didn't allow myself to feel angry, to feel sad, to feel – it felt like a death, you know, that it was a group of people that I had gotten to know and love over the last year. And even though I only met them once, actually. There were all – the creative team was all over the country, but we'd have our Monday afternoon phone calls. And this past Monday, I really felt sad at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, like, I miss my girls. You know? So, it, you know – that I allowed myself to acknowledge the loss. So what I did to be proactive is right away I put feelers out. You know, I posted something on Facebook, which is, you know, the validity of all things in our lives. You know, if it's not on Facebook, it didn't happen. You know,
right.
It becomes real when you put it out there on social media. And then I applied for different jobs. So right now what I've got is four potential. Well, they're not potential. They're all there. But four pieces of the puzzle that I'm putting together. So for right now, rather than it being a full-time job, I've got four opportunities that I'm patching together. Three of them are writing. One of them is teaching. So I really encourage people that when they experience major life change, acknowledge the loss. Don't just go right to the solution, because it kept me from feeling, literally from feeling. And this past week, I had toward the end of last week, over the weekend, I had a 3-day headache that just would not go away, and I had a hard time sleeping. And then I realized, you've got a ton of grief that you've got back there that you haven't allowed yourself to feel. So in a phone call over the weekend with a dear friend who knows me well, she said, you know, I miss my friend. And I said, you know, I haven't seen you in a while either. She said, no. I really miss you, because when you hide behind, oh, everything's okay and I'm going to get through this, you're not you. You're not real. So that was huge. And of course, I started sobbing. And then, over the last couple of days, I spent time with another dear person in my life. And in our conversation, he was talking about that too, about just cracking open and letting myself just be. And, you know, and my energy felt different when I did that. And it just felt heart opening. And when we have, you know, when I had the heart attack, it wasn't just a physical event. It was an emotional event. It was a spiritual event. And I'm still recovering from it. I mean, physically, I'm fine. Physically, you know, I go to the gym 3 or 4 times a week. I eat better. I've lost weight. I just have a better attitude. But emotionally, it's still a healing process. So I encourage people to recognize when you face major life change, don't just go to that spiritual bypass like, okay, everything's going to be okay. I mean, it will be. It really will be okay. But let yourself feel first.
And there's a lot of truth to that, because if you don't, this is my experience, it does come out sideways somewhere else. It could be physical. It could be lashing out at somebody else. It could be a whole host of things. And you're like, why did I just do that? I don't know why I just did that. And then you go, well, that's probably why you just did that. When my father passed away, my father passed away from melanoma. And then right after that, they had found some precancer in my lip. And when they went to do the surgery, it was a lot further in spiders. And I went back to work literally within days of both of those things. I was just like, I'm back. You know what I mean? I'm at that whole thing. I'm going to push right through that. Well, then when I went home to take care of my son 6 months later, whatever it was, because I was ready to not work for a place anymore, I had to come home and take home my son. It dawned on me that I had not, and it dawned because all of a sudden I'd be in all the sobbing tears and I'd be okay. And then I'd be sad. And I had never taken the time to grieve anything that happened, that my dad died from melanoma, and then I, you know, had a diagnosis myself. And I was just like, I'm okay. You know, this is life. And I wasn't okay. And sometimes I think it does take that person, you know, whether that's close friend and you're talking about support before, to say, you're not okay.
And not being okay is okay. We were talking about the loss, and I'm sorry about your dad. I'm an adult orphan. I'm an adult orphan myself, and I think that had a lot to do with it too. My dad died in 2008. My mom died in 2010, and I went into immediate social worker mode. Like, I'm going to take care of everything. I'm now the family matriarch. You know, I was my mom's executor, power of attorney, all of that stuff. And you know, and I knew on some level that you know, they're always with me, and you know, I was blessed to have had over the last 6 months of my mother's life, she lived in Florida, and I was able to go down there and be with her 7 times. So we were able to talk about what death is for her and for me, and we were able to have time together, and I didn't feel like I had any loose ends with her. I wish she had allowed me to be with her at the end, but she orchestrated it so that my sister and I were not there with her at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's how she wanted it. So I had
right.
to honor that. But I went right into minister social worker mode. I officiated at her service. I took care of her, you know, her affairs after she died. And I just went right on back to, you know, went back to work. And at the time, I was working in a psychiatric hospital where there's a lot of pressure. 2 years after that, I left that job and went to work in an outpatient drug and alcohol rehab, working with people that were healing from some pretty major wounds themselves, taking on their stuff. And, you know, working as a minister, working as a writer. I mean, I would work 12-hour-plus days at that job and then come home and be up till midnight writing, get up at 5 or 6 in the morning and start all over again. And it took its toll. So
mm-hmm.
when the heart attack happened, 2 weeks before the heart attack, I was offered that full-time writing job, which literally felt like a godsend. It's a God saying, okay, I know you can't do this work anymore, so I'm going to give you something better.
Mm-hmm.
And I just embraced it. And one of the other things that came to me was something that I heard someone say to a client who had had a serious heart attack as well. And the guy had been a CEO of a Fortune 500 company who wanted to go back to work right away. And the coach who was working with him said, don't let your heart attack go to waste. And I decided that I was not going to let my heart attack go to waste. I was going to use it to heal myself, to heal, help other people heal themselves, to have more authentic relationships, to just embrace life, you know, heart forward. And that's what I'm doing. You know, I'm much more, you know, I had a lot of armor around my heart. I realized how much, even though I, on the surface I look like a very open person, I had a lot of armor. Because I was afraid of really letting love in. You know, what would that mean if I did and that person died, you know, like my husband did, like my parents did. And the reality is everybody we know and love will one day die or leave us, or we will die or leave them. That's the reality.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it worked.
Yes. And I think that is... There is something to knowing that, but you mentioned something in there that struck a chord with me. Actually, while you were talking, I was like, you and I could be one of the same, because when tragedy
yeah.
strikes, we're just going to move forward. I feel like sometimes I'm like the army just marching in, you know, and that's not always the appropriate response. And it's taken, and it's still a lesson that I still need to learn. And so that's what I was going to ask you. When you go through loss, when you go through a painful thing and you don't go into that mode of I'm going to go fix all this, and you allow yourself to grieve, or you allow yourself to, where does it start to go from grieving or taking it, you know, allowing yourself to feel, to what is that fine line where it starts to be, now it's self-pity, I'm not moving from this, and it starts to distract you from, because I sometimes work in the levels of extreme, so I'm extremely
mm-hmm.
going to go fix everything, or I'm going to extremely, this is all going to be black and horrible and never going to get any better. And so how do you know what's some key thing that you know that you're going in either of those directions and it's time to kind of go back to the center?
Well, noticing when you don't feel grounded. I'm a Libra. Not that I believe that astrology is the be-all, end-all, but as a Libra, balance feels important to me. Love feels important to me. Peace feels important to me. You know, healthy relationships do. And when I'm feeling out of balance, like on a seesaw where I'm either up or down too much of the time, then I say, all right, what do I need to do to be more even-keeled? And taking on other people's stuff, you know, knocks me down. I can't always do it. My mother had, you know, she used to say she had broad shoulders. My mother was the rock of the family. And what I used to say to her is, Mom, you know what? Rocks crumble. So if you start to feel like a crumbling rock, then that's an indication that it's time to go back and do some self-care. We're taught often that self-care is selfish, but it's really not. It's self-sustaining. And if you, again, go back to the idea that if you can't take care of yourself, ain't no way you're going to be able to take care of somebody else. So noticing the physical symptoms, if you're feeling fatigued, if you're feeling drained. I used to say that I ran on adrenaline and fumes, and that I felt like I was running a quart low, and you know, burning the candle at both ends till there was no more wax left. And one of the other health issues that I had after the heart attack, well, let me roll back a little bit. Even before the heart attack, I had shingles 6 months before that, then the heart attack, then kidney stones, and then a diagnosis of adrenal fatigue. So, you know, my adrenals were running a quart low, or two, or ten, I don't know. So notice your physical symptoms. You know, do the best you can to take care of yourself. Exercise, nature, being with people that you love, being with animals, playing, napping. I've been taking naps. That's one of the upsides of the heart attack, is that I give myself time to nap, not feeling like I'm not being productive if I'm not doing something. So that helps. And having people in your life that remind you you don't have to do it all yourself. You know, a big lesson for me, huge lesson, has been letting people support me, because I felt like at least that I've always been the support for other people. And it's scary to trust somebody, to trust people in your life enough to hold you up some of the time. So I'm learning to do that, not because I'm needy or I'm weak or I'm sick, which is all the stuff I was telling myself, but because I'm human. And I need people in my life as much as they need me. So that's, I feel like crying when I say that, but that's been a huge revelation. You know, just allowing people to love and support me has been amazing. So bring it on.
I know for myself, that trust factor to allow, to allow yourself to be that vulnerable with people. And I think that it's just a lesson of life, of learning who to do that with that's safe. I mean, you may not pick the safest person every time, but it's just a life lesson of, okay, and being in the company of people who are going to help you rise to a higher level, and being vulnerable and saying, I need support in this area. You know, I think that's key. The other thing I do want to talk to you about is the book you're writing.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about that. That's exciting.
Okay, cool. Yeah, well, that book came along. That's my second book, actually. I have one that came out in 2011 called The Bliss Mistress Guide to Transforming the Ordinary into the Extraordinary. And those are what I call chicken soup for the soul kind of stories, slice of life stories. And they were about things that have happened over the last, 20 years of my life. And then the last two chapters were about the hospice journey I took with my mom. And then the bonus chapter was an interview that I did in 2008 with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. That was a 20-year dream into reality interview that I just loved being able to do. So that's in the book. This book is a little deeper. That one was more like decadent chocolate, very sweetness and light. I mean, if you look at, besides the fact that at the end of the book I wrote about my mom's passing, most of the things that I wrote about were fairly light kind of things. They weren't heavy duty, shadow, dark, scary, not scary like in, monster scary, but although some of them were monsters for me, some of the thoughts and feelings were monsters. But this book feels deeper. It's more dark cave exploration rather than going deeper rather than just skating on the surface of the pond. Similar writing style. And then I'm adding, I've invited a number of the movers and shakers in the transformational field to contribute their little 100 word or less blurbs about what it means to them to be an optimistic. So I've got people like Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., Bessie Chassie, who's the producer of What the Bleep. She's in it. Dr. Bernie Siegel, he contributed his, trying to think who else, while we're talking, I'll look and see. there's, you know, just a number of people who have been very generous with their, you know, their thoughts about what it means to them to be an optimistic. So I'm trying to think who else here. But that's, you know, that's a book that I'm working on right now. And like anything, the, you know, I start out with, oh, I'm really excited about it. And then the doubt monster kicks in, like, oh, you sure you can do this? And, you know, who's going to want to read this? And, you know, people like what, you know, for whatever reason, they like what I have to write. So I figured I might as well put it into a book. You know, so that feels, you know, that feels good to be able to do that, to be able to say, all right, this is part of my heart's longing. I have a wonderful muse who has become, you know, I call the muse my lover, who doesn't let me sleep sometimes, like an insatiable lover that just says, okay, come on, you got to wake up and write, you got to do this, you know. So that's what's helping me to finish the book. I don't have a target date for finishing it, though. It's still, you know, I'm still just flowing with it for right now.
And but, you know, I can tell your passion, you know, how excited you are about talking about it as you're talking.
Yeah.
And I think that's amazing. I think that when you have something in your life like that and that culminates into something, it is phenomenal where you say, okay, you can look at this person and say, or hear the passion in their voice about being able to do that. And so that's really, really exciting.
Thank you.
And so just, we have about like 5 more minutes of air, kind of air time. What was it like? Because I saw on your, now I didn't read this part earlier. Hold on, I'm going to put it. But you have interviewed some incredible, or, you know, because of journalism, some really, Wayne Dyer, I mean, Debbie Ford, Marianne Williamson, Ben and Jerry. So what is it, when you meet, you know, because some of us would be a little starstruck. So is there a different energy? Is it a different when you meet somebody who has touched, whether in whatever passionate way they are, so many lives, so many, what's that like? What's that experience
Well, there's sometimes when I think, yeah, it's just my job, it's just what I do, and then there are times that I'm totally amazed by it because I think I have the privilege of interviewing people whose work has touched, as you said, whose work has touched so many, and, you know, books that I've read or music that I've listened to or workshops that I've been to. And as my father used to say, they put their pants on one leg at a time, just like I do. So it's not, I'm not starstruck. In fact, the Dalai Lama was probably one of the easiest people to interview once I got there. I was more intimidated in anticipation of it than I was when I actually got there. He made it so safe and so easy. And I've been really blessed that most of the people that I've interviewed have been grateful for the time that we, you know, that we spent together, whether it was on the phone or in person. And most of them were very easy to interview, really genuine, from the heart people. You know, like any field, you run into what a friend of mine calls enlightened egos, you know, that on, you know, that their facade and how they really are is not always linked. But that's something that I, you know, that I really am honored to be able to do. And on my radio show, I have a blog talk show too. It's on every Thursday night called It's All About Relationships. And it is on Blog Talk Radio. Yep. Yeah, tonight. Absolutely. Thank you. 8 o'clock. It's Vivid Life, V-I-V-I-D, vividlife.me is the network or the station. And it's called It's All About Relationships. So that's something that I, you know, that I value as well, is being able to communicate with people that way too. So I interview guests just like you do. And by the way, you're a marvelous interviewer. I can tell you that you've made it very easy for me to just open up and spill my guts all over the place. So thank you.
Well, and you know, thank you, because it's been a process, and now I really like doing this. At first I was like, and now I've realized that if I just let it flow, they're phenomenal. And the real big secret is to talk about self-care, is that, like, no matter what guest I have on, it's what I need that week. It's just amazing how that works. And why I took that hiatus, I have no clue, because it's just been, you know, and week after week, it's just been phenomenal. So just in the last few minutes, so And I could understand, and I like how you call it the enlightened ego. I can see that. But anybody who's looking to get into the journalism and feels like they'll never get to that level, or do you have any tips for them?
Mm-hmm, sure. Well, first of all, if you love to write, write. Don't let anything stop you. And it doesn't have to be a word count. It doesn't have to be, I'm going to write 1,000 words today. You just write what your heart tells you to write. Use everything in your life as a writing prompt. Everything you see, everything you feel. Do full sensory writing. Just let your senses just run amok. If you want to submit articles and blogs, there are all kinds of websites out there. I write for the Huffington Post, Elephant Journal, Good Men Project, BeliefNet. Do a research project on how to write for them, and they'll give you writer's guidelines. Write for your friends. Write a blog post on Facebook. Just get the words out there, because if they're in you, they're not. I mean, as a dear friend told me who prompted me to finish writing my first book, the book's not doing anybody any good in your head. Publish the damn book already. Get it out there. And the same thing is true with your writing. If you've got a passion for writing, share it with the world. If you've got a valuable message, get it out there, and you'll feel a whole lot better too.
Thank you so much, Edie. We are about out of time.
My
I'm going to go into.
Pleasure.
It has been phenomenal. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I really have enjoyed our time
together.
Me too.
Thank you.
So thank you again. We are going to, just so that everybody knows, we're going to play Edie's information right now so you know how to get in contact with this phenomenal lady. I just want to let everybody know that we are scheduled to have Lisa Steinbach on next week, and she is an interior designer here in Louisville, and I'm excited to have her on the show because she's been on TV shows, and she does what's called a homorama every year here, and she is just phenomenal at what she does. So we'll talk about her journey and how she stays on top and has been successful for many years in the design business. So again, Edie, thank you, thank you, thank you. And
my pleasure.
I look forward
thank
to
you
talking with you. You're welcome. You're welcome. I look forward to meeting with everybody again next week. And right now we're going to go to our commercials.
Edie Weinstein welcomes you into her world as she offers her creative writing skills for your publication. Some of the places she is honored to have showcased her words include The Huffington Post, BeliefNet, Elephant Journal, The Good Man Project, Wisdom Magazine, Bella Mia Magazine, Inner Child Magazine, and Bel Esprit Magazine. Edie has interviewed hundreds of notables in her journalistic career that spans nearly three decades, including Deepak Chopra, Debbie Ford, Ram Dass, Wayne Dyer, Neil Donald Walsh, Marianne Williamson, Ben & Jerry, Ariel Ford, Oriah Mountain Dreamer, and His Holiness, the Dalai Lama. She is a dynamic and entertaining speaker who reaches audiences with her moving stories and engaging participant experiential exercise. Authentic, she peels off the layers to reveal the real. You can contact her via www.optimystical.com. You've been listening to Love, Light, and Passion with Wendy Manganaro. Visit her at www.socialabundancemarketing.com.